The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Let's see, how's the volume? Does it seem okay? Okay. So, I just finished on Saturday teaching a retreat, a short retreat, and we had a theme for the retreat, and that was right intention. And since that's fresh on my mind, I would like to give a talk this evening on this topic. So right intention is the second factor in what's known as the Eightfold Path. And in Buddhism, the Eightfold Path is one of the central frameworks for holding a Buddhist practice, to understanding it or organizing it into a coherent whole. It's a beautiful system, the Eightfold Path. And the second one is usually translated as right intention. And intention is a very important topic. There's one Buddhist saying that says everything rests on the tip of your intention, meaning that your intention kind of guides and supports and everything. It's kind of behind everything. And so to understand what your intentions are and clarifying them and coming forth with what's called wise intention or right intention is a very important part of the Buddhist approach to life. And before I explain what this word means and what this means and what should probably be maybe an alternative translation into English rather than intention, kind of the Buddhist approach to a spiritual life, to this path of freedom, is not so concerned with what you are or who you are or what experiences you want to have, but it has a lot to do with how you are. And the how you are is really the focus of the if you can get organize your how you approach life, how you walk through your life, everything else kind of follows in the wake of that or fits together like a puzzle. And this idea of right intention or wise intention focuses on this how. How are we? And the word that's being translated as right intention, the Pali word is samma sankappa, which literally means complete way of thinking. So sankappa means thinking, or the kappa means thinking, and san means with. It's how we think with our life. It's a way of thinking, how we approach our thinking about things. And probably the best English translation is attitude. What's the attitude we have as we go about our life? What attitude do we have for our work? What attitude do we have for talking with a friend? What's the attitude we have when we're washing dishes or cooking or cleaning? What's the attitude we have about whatever experiences we have? If we have challenges, what attitude do we bring to bear on those challenges? If we have great joys, what's the attitude to those joys? And so attitude is how we hold all our experiences. The word intention, sometimes I don't think of it as a very good translation for this word because I don't know how it is for you, but in my mind, intention has this kind of narrow focus. I feel narrower when I say, what's your intention? Or you have an intention, like have intent. It's like, yeah, you kind of bear down or focus. Whereas what's your attitude for me makes me more spacious. It kind of opens it up. And intention has a little bit more of a mental quality to me, kind of a little bit too much intellectual. Whereas attitude, at least for me, it just feels like all of me is included. So it's like something much more integrated and holistic. What's the attitude you bring? And the attitude you have, applies everywhere, and it applies no matter what other intentions, purposes, motivations you have for what you do. So you might have an intention or motivation to serve other people. And then you can ask, well, what's your attitude in which you're serving other people? What's your attitude towards that intention? There might be attitudes of conceit. There might be attitudes of, look at me, how great I am. There might be attitudes of fear. There might be attitudes of hostility. I want to serve people because I want to push away all the problems people have with because I'm angry. We carry with us attitudes behind the purposes we go about our life with. And so to look at those attitudes that support our intentions, purposes we have in our life, again, is so important. So how are we? How are you? How are you when you go about whatever is happening? What's your way of thinking about it? What's your approach of holding it? What's your attitude? So the Eightfold Path is a path towards freedom. And freedom is probably for some people best understood as an unfettered heart, an unfettered mind, an unconstricted, unrestricted heart. The heart is just spacious and buoyant and open and not limited in any kind of way. There's no clingings or fears or that hold us down, weigh us down. There's kind of a lightness of heart that's there and free. And in this goal, freedom from suffering, right intention are the three attitudes that support us on that path. And so if you want freedom, then these are the attitudes which to carry with you, keep close at heart, and see when you go through your life and look at what you're doing, bring those attitudes to bear. Try to work with them and have those attitudes. And there are three attitudes that the Buddha lists as part of this right intention or right attitude. And they're very interesting intentions. And I like to think of them as part of our treasure, inner wealth. We have tremendous wealth. Buddhism says we have wealth inside, treasures inside of us that far surpassed any possible treasures we can have in our bank account or in jewelry or, you know, anything that the external world can provide. And I would say that the most beautiful thing that I've ever seen in my life, and I've seen many beautiful things in nature and beautiful things, is a pure heart that you see in yourself. It's just unsurpassable in preciousness and value and wealth. And so we have inside of us, all of us have inside of this treasure. And these the right intentions are part of this treasure, and they can become the gifts that we bring to the world. And a lot to do about these right attitudes are very closely connected to how we live our life, our social life, how we live with the world around us and people around us. It's not only about, you know, what's in it for me. So there are three right intentions or wise attitudes. And I'm going to list them the first one last, because the first one is the least popular. You know, so I don't want to turn you off, you know, at the beginning. So I'll save it for the end. And you'll be so inspired by the time you hear the last one that you'll kind of, oh, yes, you're willing to hear it. So so start with the second. And the second is goodwill or loving kindness, metta. The literal word is non-hostility. So to have an attitude of not being hostile or in conflict with anything. Now, conflict is not the right word, but not being hostile towards anything. And even if you're in conflict with people, you do so without any hostility. But the way that the ancient language, Pali language, works, that the word, meaning the absence of hostility, implies loving kindness. And that's usually how it's taught. So loving kindness is goodwill, friendliness, kindness. Are some of the words connected to this. And this is seen to be a gift that we bring to the world. It's also considered to be one of the great treasures inside, the capacity for goodwill, capacity for loving kindness. And we bring our goodwill to the people around us. And to approach whatever we're doing with an attitude of goodwill, of well-wishing, even if you're in conflict with someone or someone is, you know, troublesome, can you find inside of you a feeling of wishing them well? Even if it's just wishing them well so they can leave you alone. You know, wishing them well so they can kind of, you know, not be so difficult. And, you know, that's all, if that's what it takes to get your goodwill going, that's, you know, that's, let's settle for that. And so that's the first one, you know, this goodwill. The second one is compassion. And this is also a gift to... So more than just goodwill, but to care about people's suffering, to have a tender, caring heart for this suffering world of ours. And as we go about whatever we're doing, to go about keeping compassion close at heart, close by. And we run into many challenges with other people and with ourselves throughout the day, and to always be ready to kind of meet those with a caring heart, a tender heart, a compassionate heart, is really valuable for this path of liberation. The literal word here that's translated as compassion, or explained as compassion, is a famous word now since the 20th century. I think most of you probably know this Sanskrit word, ahimsa. And if you don't know it, learn it tonight. Ahimsa. And ahimsa is the word that Gandhi championed. And it means, Gandhi translated as non-violence. It can literally mean non-harming. And so have an attitude of non-harming. So try not to cause harm or try to minimize the harm. And that's an attitude. Wherever you do, whatever you're trying to do, try to do it so there's a minimized amount of harm, or don't cause harm when you do it. But because a negative in Pali often implies the positive, it's usually taught to mean have compassion. And to have compassion for the world is a gift that we bring. To have compassion for ourselves is a gift that we bring. So now we come to the one that people sometimes here in the West don't care for. Or, you know, this is the... But if we remember, these are gifts. These are treasures inside. And so you have to kind of, you know, don't close your ears as soon as you hear this word. Don't give up on me. Yes, don't give up. And so the word, the way it's translated into English, is renunciation. It was sounded good until now. Renunciation is. You probably had some doubts about Buddhism, and there we go. Snuck in that word, renunciation. I like to think of it as simplicity. To carry a kind of a simplicity of heart, simplicity of being, simplicity of life with whatever we do as opposed to an accumulating one. And there's a few images I have for this idea of renunciation. And one is, if you want to go on a path, remember the Eightfold Path is a path to freedom. If you want to go for a hike in a mountain path, go backpacking, and you want to make sure you bring enough things with you to be comfortable up deep in the mountains on your many-day, maybe two-week hike. So you start packing the things you're going to bring with you. So it's important to bring lots of food and cookies, donuts, chocolate of different types. It's important to bring some electronics, because you might have a signal, but then you need to have a charger, and then maybe a television, and a radio, And it's important to have lots of nice clothes, because you don't know who you're going to run into up there in the mountains. So you want to bring your grubby clothes for the hike, but then, you know, when you get to camp, you want to be able to bring out your nice dresses and nice clothes. And then you want to have good, you know, you want to cook good food, so you pack in one suitcase, you do, you have all this food, but you also have a really nice gas-burning stove with really your favorite pots, and it goes on and on. So you gather all the stuff together. By the time you're ready to go out on the trail, you're carrying these huge trunks, not just suitcases, but trunks of stuff. And you start moving down the trail, you know, and it's hard work. You can maybe take one of them at a time and walk 2 feet, go back to the other one and do 2 feet, and you're not going to make it very far. And after a while, you realize this is not working. I think I need to renounce all this extra stuff I have. And so you start letting go and shedding. And it takes a few days to realize that you don't need most of it as you're walking in the mountains. You need very little of it. And so you shed and you shed and you shed until you're left with really what you need in order to live successfully in the mountains. So in the same way, renunciation, so we shed all the stuff, we shed what's extra that limits us, that weighs us down, that prevents us from moving freely on this mountain path and easily. So in the path to liberation, to freedom, we want to shed the things that hold us down, that weigh us down, that get in our way. And there are many things that people are attached to in our lives that they hold on to for dear life that kind of interfere with the movement towards freedom, interfere with the movement to living lightly, openly, relaxedly. Sometimes it's appropriate to let go of some of the activities we do and some of the things we have. It doesn't have to be out of hostility, or it doesn't have to be moralistically. It's just pragmatically that these things stand in the way of being free and open. The other image, the Pali word, the ancient Indian word for that's translated into English as renunciation, means more literally. It has two meanings. One's a pun, and one's kind of maybe their more original meaning. The pun is it means non-lust. It doesn't quite mean that, but it almost looks like the word non-lust in Pali. So lust is considered to be not so helpful if you want to become free. But it also means going forth. So it's more about going forth into open air than it is about what you're letting go of. It's more about what you gain than what you lose. And I think the word renunciation, when many people hear it, they focus on what they're deprived of. But the focus is what you gain in the process. And the image I use for this is, you've heard this maybe many times from me, is if you're stuck in a mountain, one-room mountain cabin, snowed in for 3 months, with all your relatives. You love your relatives, most of them, but even with all the love, 3 months in a one-room cabin, it can't even leave. It's snowed in completely, you know, and there's no proper ventilation, you know, and maybe no shower. You know, it gets pretty. And then finally the spring comes and the snow melts, and finally you could open the door, finally you can go out, and you go out into the grass and the meadow and flowers or whatever, and it's just like so great. You've gone forth, you've renounced that, you know, you renounced that cooped up cabin, and it's so great to be free and out and available to the world. That's a little bit more the connotations of this word, nikama, or renunciation. It's like moving into something beautiful and wonderful that we gain in the process. So to have the courage and the motivation and the wisdom to know what we don't need to have, what gets in our way, what weighs us down. Not a few people nowadays would probably do really well in renouncing television. I think that if you're interested in the path of freedom, spending a lot of time on the web doesn't really help. It doesn't really support something. There's beautiful ways to go out, go forth into open air, wide space, both literally and other ways, that are available to you if you don't watch TV so much. So I don't know, maybe none of you watch TV. But that, I think that's, for some people, that's a really easy place. And then sometimes we have to look at what happens when we don't use on the internet, searching, surfing, watching TV, watching movies, whatever people do. What happens to you? What are you left with when you're left with yourself? Is there better use of your time? Is there some place to step, move forward into that actually is refreshing and opening for you? But as an attitude, renunciation is an attitude of being simple, not carrying a lot of agendas and thoughts and plans and expectations and fears as we go about, to kind of travel lightly, travel lightly with your self-identity, travel lightly with with all your wants and desires. So when you step into different situations with this attitude of renunciation, you're kind of entering situations with fresh mind, with fresh eyes, as if you're stepping into something new rather than something where you bring with you all your history and all your stories and all your ideas of your past and, you know, what you've learned before. But you meet a friend, you meet another person you've known before, and then renunciation would be to be to have an attitude of meeting the person fresh and new, rather than based on the old ideas that we, that bring old attitudes. So the attitude of renunciation, the attitude of loving kindness, and the attitude of compassion. And now it's easy not to have this. It's easy to have the opposite. I want to feel safe, I want more things, I want more pleasure, I want more comfort, I deserve. It's easy to have hostility in a world where there's a lot of hostility coming towards us, a lot of challenges coming towards us. There's a lot of pain and suffering, and hostility sometimes is one strategy to try to push away or deal with the tremendous struggles that some people have, some of us have. And it's, not so uncommon to have actually kind of more than hostility, kind of actively kind of want to harm other people and not to have compassion. So it's easy, and sometimes it could almost be logical or reasonable to have those in certain situations. So the practice of right intention involves looking at all that, an honest look, and kind of giving a little bit of the benefit of the doubt to the Buddha, who said the intentions to have are renunciation, kindness, and compassion. You don't have to believe it, but you can give the Buddha enough of a benefit of the doubt that you try arguing with him. Try engaging it. Be in a process of conversation. Explore it and see if it's true. See if it might be true. Come up with good reasons why it might not be true. Try to kind of grapple with it. Don't just kind of come to quick opinions, but really, try to get to the bottom of what your beliefs are and what's going on for you and what you think the value is and benefit is from not coming from goodwill, kindness, and renunciation. What's really going on for you? I think that there's a lot of learning to be happened with that kind of contemplation and learning. Also, then, if you do that kind of more careful reflection about it, then when you do engage in an attitude of renunciation, an attitude of kindness and compassion, you might do it a lot wiser. Wise compassion, wise kindness, wise renunciation. So these are three attitudes about how we are, and these are treasures. And the Buddhist tradition encourages us to protect these treasures. keep these ideas, these attitudes close at heart, and this is the heart of who you are. You know, so the kind of, you know, what you are, what experiences you have, are not as important in the long term than the attitudes that you bring to what you do, to what happens in your life. That's where spiritual growth happens. That's where we create karma, the momentum of conditioning that supports us. And so to kind of constantly reflect, what's my attitude right now? Do I have an attitude of kindness, of compassion? What would be an appropriate way to have kindness and compassion in this situation? And to make it a habit, make it a kind of a touchstone for our life, for understanding our life. And then part of the reason that this is part of the path of liberation is that in an ideal world, the means is directly connected to the goal. The goal is reflected in the means. The means grows into the goal because it partakes of the goal. It's part of the goal. So in that the goal of one of the goals of practice is to have a loving heart, loving kindness and compassion, then, you know, you can't really get to a loving heart if your attitude is one of hostility and anger and hate. That just doesn't work. It's like going in the wrong direction. You can't really discover freedom where we learn to have the heart not clinging to anything at all if we're have an attitude of clinging and holding on to things. Renunciation, letting go, is closely connected to non-clinging. Loving kindness and compassion is closely connected to a loving heart. That's the goal. Someone becomes spiritually mature. So to have these connected from the beginning, don't wait until you have these, but explore and develop and kind of bring these attitudes. The final thing I'd like to say about this attitude thing is that you might not feel loving. You might not feel compassion. And that's reasonable in our lives. And there's something about the word attitude or that maybe kind of might imply that it's supposed to be a mood you're supposed to have. You don't feel loving, and now you're telling me I'm supposed to have this feeling of love towards other or compassion to other. It's kind of too difficult. But literally, the word sankappa means thinking, an approach, a way of thinking, how to think about things. So, if attitude seems like too high a bar, then what it means is, in the situation where you feel hostile, it's the exercise of reflection to consider what in what way might I be able to genuinely, authentically bring kindness to this situation, have goodwill, have compassion. What way might I understand the value of letting go in this situation so it's beneficial for me? It's a way of thinking. It's an exercise of thinking. So the right intention in Buddhism doesn't tell you what your purpose should be in terms of the particular details of what you do during the day, but it does encourage you to spend some time reflecting about how you're thinking about it and how you approach it, and the attitude that you have as you do it. And it turns out it's more important what your attitude is, or the way that you think, than what you actually do many, many times, oftentimes. So right intention, right attitude, right way of thinking. So your thoughts now. Do you have any comments or questions or protests, anything you'd like to ask.
You said something about the important distinction between conflict and hostility. That conflict, I think, doesn't necessarily imply hostility. That it's important to have conflict.
It can be. Yeah, I mean, conflict is... conflict just means that... what does it mean? It means two people disagree about this, how things should be. And that's reasonable that people disagree. And so if you have to come to a common agreement, there can initially be a conflict in opinions and views and preferences and understandings. And there doesn't have to be any conflict whatsoever, any hostility whatsoever. There can be lots of love and care and respect for each other. And also there can be understanding that conflict is actually very valuable. I think of it as creative tension, and that sometimes it's really nice to stay in a conflict. I've been in situations where I've been having a conversation with someone and we disagreed about something, and maybe we got a little bit animated, a little bit engaged in the disagreement, like this way, that way, and then the person said, "Okay, well, we'll just do it your way." And I said, no. Let's stay in the conflict. Let's stay in this disagreement and go back and forth, because there might be a third option. And the creative tension, the tension of staying with it, and until we think of something, a third option none of us have thought about that works for both of us. So I think conflict, is a valuable part of life, and we should... I think it's an art. It's an art and skill to learn how to stay in it, and work with it, and bring out the best in everyone. How's that sound?
It's just interesting that sometimes it's with some people, and the way I am, and the way that person is, it's quite easy to be in a creative conflict and appreciate each other. And at other times with other people and other dynamics, it's so easy to get into feelings of hostility.
Right. So then it becomes an area of practice. So it's easy, and so we don't have to be, no need to feel critical of yourself. You can have compassion for yourself, for the suffering of having hostility. It hurts you to have hostility. But you can have compassion. But then you can engage in a process of reflection, exploration. What's happening for you? What's going on? How can you? What's really going on under the surface? Is this something you really want to stay with? Is it another way that might be more beneficial for you and for everyone else? And so this is where practice is important. And so if the hostility is strong, maybe go meditate and sit with it and be with it until it passes, or go for a walk, or talk with another friend and kind of talk it out, and so you kind of work through it. I think be interested in moving through hostility to the other side rather than acting from it is very, very important. It's very important not to give authority to the hostility. It's very important to respect it, but to work through it and to engage in it and find the other side of it. Learn how to not just let go of it, just quickly let go and that be done with it, but to actually engage with it, to really get to the bottom of it, what drives it, what motivates it, and see if you can find a valuable alternative.
I have a question.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I have a question about, you were talking about renunciation in terms of limiting television and internet which is an area I think I have found myself quite addicted to the internet many times. And I will get on my computer, and then 3 hours later, I'll kind of look up and go, where did the time go? And I guess it's an area that I want to explore. And I'm trying to think of different ways that maybe could you talk a little bit more about ways to explore it? Because I think it's, at least for me in this day and age, it seems pretty impossible to completely give it up cold turkey.
Sure.
But it would be nice to find ways of relating to it that are more skillful than what I feel I'm currently doing.
The one possibility is before you turn it on, open it up, sit down and meditate for 2 minutes, maybe in front of your computer, your device. But really meditate and ask yourself why you're doing this. What's motivating? What's driving it? What are the feelings? What's the purpose? What's happening for you? And if you'd find that it's mostly escape or mostly trying to, you know, unwind or comfort yourself, is that the best way to do it? So giving yourself that little pause, 2 minute pause, 5 minute pause, might be very important, and you might find that that's long enough that if it's a more kind of automatic habit, it might break the habit a little bit. And then, you can also put a timer on. So at some interval, 30 minutes, 15 minutes, 5 minutes, I don't know how often, the timer reminds you, I'm on the internet. And then you hear the timer, and maybe the timer is a little bit far away, so you have to get up somewhere else to turn it off. So it gives you a pause to reflect on what's going on. So you're not just kind of swept into that world. And then it's not just enough, and then do the same thing. Notice what's happening to you. I mean, what works best if you develop self-understanding. Just having policies about why you should be one way or the other is not so helpful. So use something and pause every half an hour and do this self-reflection, self-exploration. What's happening for you? Is this really serving you? Why are you doing it? Is this the best way to do it? Is there better things to be doing with your time? Then you'll become wiser over time. How does that sound?
Good starting point. Thank you.
Okay. Here, up here in the front, because otherwise it's all men.
Thank you. I also have problems with renunciation, and I keep working on it and working, and I don't get very far. So the question is, how do you figure out how many suitcases is it okay to drag with you into the mountains? I have such good explanations why I need all that stuff. It's just
But who's doing the dragging?
Well, mostly me, actually. But yeah, sometimes I get help.
Yeah, it's a good question, you know, what do we need? And it's hard sometimes to know what we need and what we don't need. I think it's probably better, maybe it's better to sometimes err on the side of taking care of yourself and bringing more than you need or having more things. But sometimes it's good to experiment with the opposite and challenge yourself. And you have to figure out when is it safe to challenge yourself and try to do with less. And you might find that actually it's nicer to have less. So to trial and error, experiment, and see what might work. But one of the fundamental approaches to a mindful life is to keep looking more deeply into yourself and what motivates you. Are you being motivated by fear or by wisdom? Are you motivated by comfort or by simplicity? You know, what's really motivating you? And as you understand yourself better and better, you probably discover that there's layers and layers of fear that motivate a lot of the hoarding or wanting and things to bring.
I don't know. I just think I enjoy the damn stuff too much.
You enjoy them, okay? So then, looking at the enjoyment, and then ask yourself, what's more, is it more enjoyable to have all these things and all the caring and work to keep it, and money you have to collect in order to buy it, and there's a lot of work that goes into some of these pleasures we have. Or is there simpler, easier pleasures that, just taking a walk in the park, sitting and meditating, having a cup of tea, can that be a high enough quality activity that it nourishes you and feeds you in the bigger picture? Because pleasure by itself often doesn't feed something, doesn't feed our hearts. And so is there something deeper we can do that really feeds and nourishes the goodness in us that pleasure can't maybe never do? Is the kind of reflection I would do. Maybe one more in the back.
So I think I heard you describe kama as the momentum of conditioning. Is that?
I said something like that. I said use the word karma for those who don't know what kama is.
Yes, so karma. So that's a beautiful way to describe it within the context of your talk here. Can you say just a little bit more about how that would unfold within this idea of cultivating attitudes?
I think that the attitude that you have is part of the conditioning that we create, we reinforce in ourselves. So if we have an attitude of hostility, then we're reinforcing that conditioning. And if we do enough of it, it becomes a habit to be hostile. If we cultivate kindness or goodwill, that becomes more and more of a conditioning that's ready at hand. The gears have been oiled, so they work really smoothly and easily and ever ready to go rather than rusty. So that creates a different condition, momentum over time.
Great. Thank you.
You know, so if you've been practicing goodwill and developing it, you suddenly find yourself in a challenging situation, and you say, what should I do? And, oh, goodwill. I don't know what to do here, but let's at least have goodwill. This person is, this is a very difficult situation, but let's see, what would be the kind thing to do in this situation? How to hold this person kindly or something? And so that, and maybe because you have that habit, it might protect you in a challenging situation.
And it strikes me also that if one holds that in mind, they can appreciate the what goes into actually cultivating habit. So I love that, the momentum of conditioning.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful, elegant description.
Yeah, and momentum doesn't stop suddenly.
Right.
So that, people sit down to meditate, they discover there's momentum of thinking, of concerns and emotions, and you can't just push a button and stop it. It has to play itself out to some degree and work itself out. So you have to be patient sometimes. The really strong thinking keeps going, certain emotions keep going, and over time they settle. But the momentum is there until the force dissipates. So the same thing, so it depends. So what is the condition? What's the momentum that you put in place? And if it's painful momentum, then you have to live with that pain for a while. If it's enjoyable momentum, inner enjoyment, then that momentum will last you for a while. And then not only will it last, but also then it supports further goodness.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so you might think about the attitude and your attitudes and what attitudes you bring and to see in what way the attitudes you bring and what attitudes you can bring into your life where that you feel nourish, benefit, and grow something beautiful inside of you. There's treasures inside waiting for you. And attitude is one of the ways to discover and develop those treasures. Great. Thank you.